Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Litton, and I'm the host of Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. As a reminder to our listeners, the show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions on air by dialing 347-994-1149. If you want to jot that down, it is 347-994-1149, and then you're going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question, and you will be placed in a queue. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. Today, we're going to be talking about the prevalence of trauma in youth involved in the juvenile justice system, its implications for treatment and rehabilitation efforts, and recommendations for system response. Just like anything pertaining to people, a one-size-fits-all approach does not work. Therefore, when trauma is an issue, it needs to be accounted for. One guiding principle I found is if we don't look for or acknowledge trauma in the lives of children and adolescents, we end up chasing behaviors and limiting the possibilities for change. I think that's quite profound, and I'm looking forward to our guests discussing that and other concepts. Speaking of our guests, we have three people joining us today. They are Dr. Sean C. March, who is the director of the Juvenile and Family Law Department of the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges. He is a social psychologist with research and teaching interests in the areas of psychology and the law, juvenile justice, resiliency, positive youth development, and social cognition. His background includes substantial experience working with youth in correctional settings as an educator and mental health clinician. He is a licensed school counselor, professional counselor, and clinical professional counselor. Dr. Marsh is affiliated with several academic departments at the University of Nevada, and his research appears in scholarly journals such as Youth Violence and Juvenile Justice, Health Psychology, Offender Rehabilitation, Victims and Offenders, and School Violence. Dr. Erna Olafson has many titles. She is the director of the Program on Child Abuse Forensic and Treatment Training within the Childhood Trust, Director of Training for the Trauma Treatment Training Center at Cincinnati's Children's Hospital Medical Center, and is the director of the Forensic Training Institute. She is also an associate professor of clinical psychiatry and pediatrics at Cincinnati Children's and the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. As training director, Dr. Olafson trains mental health professionals in trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, parent-child interaction therapy, childhood traumatic grief, and psychological first aid. She is also the co-chair of the National Child Traumatic Stress Network's Justice System Workgroup and is on the advisory board for the American Prosecutors Research Institute Half a Nation Finding Words Training Program. Last but not least is the Honorable Michael Howard, who has been a judge in the Family Court Division of the Stark County, Ohio Court of Common Pleas since first elected in 2004. Judge Howard is active as a community volunteer, focusing primarily on programs helping children achieve success and avoid delinquent behavior. He chairs the Stark County Traumatized Child Task Force and the Leadership Committee of the United Way of Greater Stark County. He is a member of the Advisory Board and the Justice Consortium of the National Child Trauma Stress Network and served on the Ohio Department of Mental Health Childhood Trauma Task Force. Additionally, he was appointed to the Ohio Supreme Court Board of Character and Fitness, serves on the Ohio Supreme Court's Advisory Committee on Domestic Violence, and on the Stark County Bar Association's Family Law and Citizenship Committees. Judge Howard has been honored as a distinguished alumnus of Kent State University Stark Campus and has received the Gold Key Award for Outstanding Community Service from the United Way of Greater Stark County. I would like to welcome all three of you to Spotlight on Youth.
Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you, Lauren.
Sean, I'd like to have you start us off today because I think most people, when they're thinking of trauma, only associate it with treatment options. But the National Council of Juvenile Family Court Judges has urged courts to look at this issue and incorporate that lens systemically. So perhaps you can start by telling us what is the National Council of Juvenile Family Court Judges?
Absolutely, it'd be my pleasure. Well, the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges is the nation's oldest judicial membership organization. We were founded in 1937. We are currently housed at the University of Nevada, Reno. We do work in several program areas. My department is the Juvenile and Family Law Department, so we focus primarily on those issues with a particular emphasis on juvenile justice, work in juvenile courts and probation, detention centers, that type of thing. We have a department entitled the Permanency Planning for Children Department. They're primarily concerned with abuse and neglect issues in courts. We have a Family Violence Department, which, as the name suggests, is interested in all things related to violence within families, domestic violence, and court responses to such. And then lastly, we have a research arm, an independent research arm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and that's the National Center for Juvenile Justice. And they are kind of the primary pipeline for research in all areas of juvenile justice and maintain a lot of national statistics for the Department of Justice and other agencies. And really the mission of the National Council, and I'll refer to it as the National Council, it's easier than the acronym, is to focus on improving outcomes for children, youth, families, victims, communities through improved case processing, education for the judiciary and allied professionals, particularly those working in juvenile and family courts.
Great. So why did the National Council take an interest in trauma-informed care for juveniles?
Well, there's kind of two prongs to that answer. There's my history with the National Council, and then there's more extended history, and I'd actually defer to Erna when I get to that point of about the Child Traumatic Stress Network. But one of the things that really brought this to the forefront for us is over the last few years an understanding and appreciation for the idea of themes that run across case types that we see in juvenile and family courts. So instead of looking at the system as very siloed as it is in many places, we see dependency court, delinquency court, family court, and they all see different case types. We really wanted to look at those themes, those issues that cross through the children and families that are in front of all these case types. So we started looking at, instead of just dependency, abuse, and neglect, we started asking questions about mental health across the lifespan. Substance abuse is another one that we look at. Trauma came in, education, all those kinds of things that run from birth to death, as we like to say. And really it was an effort to kind of treat children and families more holistically, from a more developmental life course perspective, with the idea that we wanted to improve outcomes across the lifespan and from generation to generation. And acknowledging and teaching about and researching on trauma was a critical aspect, because we know it is such a common component for the children, youth, and families that come before the judges we work with. And then, as I started with, there's a longer history with the Child Traumatic Stress Network, which I've done some work with in recent years and some publications, but Erna has a much more extensive, as actually Judge Howard has, with that organization. So I would defer to them if they wanted to expand on that.
This is Erna Olufsen, and thank you, Sean. That was very interesting. And to add to that, when the Trauma Treatment Training Center came into the National Child Traumatic Stress Network at the end of 2002. I had been an expert witness for some years before then, and I was frustrated by the fact that that's a very difficult way to influence or educate judicial systems and juvenile court systems. And so I had been very interested in collaborating with judicial organizations. And with Joy Osofsky, we started what came to be called the Justice Consortium. And at the same time, the Juvenile Justice Work Group was also founded. And so we began our collaboration with NCJFCJ, with the National Council, really in 2004, and collaborated to write articles for the Juvenile and Family Court Journal. We put out a special issue in 2006. And another special issue in 2008, addressing the impact of trauma on child development and other issues. Julian Ford, who was very active in the network, published an article in the 2006 issue about the progression for many youth from being active as children, independency, court replacement, and safety were issues, to then showing up in the same courtrooms a few years later in the juvenile system. We also conducted focus groups with judges, so it was very much a collaboration where we listened to them and they listened to us, and we needed to know how could we be useful to them, and tried to open communication. And it was through that collaboration that I got to know Judge Mike Howard, who's in my same state, but I wouldn't have known him otherwise, and Dr. Sean Marsh. And we have worked together. Judge Howard and I have presented together at conferences, both NCJFCJ and National Council conferences on these issues. Judge Howard, I'm sure you have things to add.
Well, I think I'd like to come back and revisit some of, like, sort of the impact of all three of you working together. But I know we have listeners on who might not even know what we mean when we're talking about trauma. So if you don't mind, Dr. Olson, I think that we need to step back a little bit. And you've been talking about this increased intention of long-term effects of violence and trauma. So when we refer to trauma, can you explain what we mean?
I would be glad to. Thank you for the question. There's a narrow definition of trauma in the psychiatric manual I'm going to address first, and then a broader definition that we also use. In the narrower definition, it encompasses exposure to a terrifying event or events, such as being in combat or being raped or witnessing severe violence or death, and the experience of the person going through this is described as fear, helplessness, and horror. And the words also include fear about death or loss of bodily integrity. Now, the threat can be to oneself or to someone else that's close to you, such as witnessing a family member being severely beaten or killed, witnessing a friend shot to death on the street. And these are also traumas. In the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, we often use a broader definition so that we call it traumatic stress. And we also refer to childhood adversities. And these would include exposure to a severely mentally ill or substance abusing caregiver, being neglected, experiencing emotional abuse, having a parent who is incarcerated. And these adverse childhood experiences have been very thoroughly studied by Dr. Feliti and Anda in what we call the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, or ACEs. And in fact, in this March 21st, 2010 New Yorker, there's an article about the ACE studies, the Adverse Childhood Experiences Studies, which is, I think, the first time they have received the attention they deserve in the national non-professional press. Judge Howard, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I wondered if Judge Howard wanted to add anything about the ACEs, or shall we wait till later about the adverse childhood experiences?
Well, I think the ACEs study has been something that had a profound effect. Learning about that had a profound effect on our treatment, especially of children in dependency, neglect, and abuse cases. We always knew that those children had been damaged either psychologically or physically. But I think there was an assumption that if they were taken out of a bad situation, if they were warm, dry, fed in foster care, that they could be, that they would rehabilitate themselves. In other words, get better just because they were in a safe environment. Kids are resilient. They recover from these things. There's no need to deal with it. However, when we saw the ACEs study and began to see the long-term health effects on individuals who had adverse childhood experiences, we realized that resiliency in some cases, not in all, but in some cases, is overstated. Our faith in that is overstated, and that kids do not necessarily get better unless we do something to intervene and try to mitigate or eliminate the effects of the trauma on the kids as they're growing up.
Well, we already have a question, and Dr. Olson, I think you mentioned some of these. The question is about what are some of the main traumas children experience, and I think I I've read, and you can correct me if I'm wrong because this isn't my area of expertise, but even natural disasters or can cause trauma, which makes me think of what's going on in Japan and right now. So can you maybe run through a list of some of the most common things that are that cause trauma in children's lives?
Well, yes, there are first interpersonal traumas. When we look at the lists of either adverse childhood experiences or traumas, we have exposure to substance abusing parents as parents or caregivers and domestic violence, then being physically abused, accidents, injuries, medical trauma, and then some children are traumatized by multiple placements, but we do also have natural disasters that are defined as traumatic events, such as the earthquake and flood, tsunami in Japan. In this area, that might be a flooding. It might be a tornado, a severe hurricane. In California, again, it would be earthquakes. So those are other forms of trauma. Having a house fire is another kind of trauma. The list is quite long, but there is a difference in reaction if the trauma is intentional by another person to you, such as being beaten or raped or hurt in some way or shot at. And if it's a natural disaster, the consequences are somewhat different in terms of the symptom pattern.
And the consequences also are worse if it's committed by a caregiver or someone that the child should be able to trust, and if the consequences are also cumulative if the trauma goes on unresolved for long periods of time, occurs over and over and over again.
So when you have polyvictimization, you have more severe symptoms, whereas many people who are listening to us have been through one or another potentially traumatic event without symptoms, but it's the dose effect that is overwhelms systems.
And Ernie, you might want to mention here, I know you worked with juveniles at the Hillcrest facility in Cincinnati, and these were pretty deep-end kids that were in residential care lockup. Actually, and what was the total number of traumas that they averaged?
Well, should I talk about just that one facility or the rates that are known nationally?
Well, you can talk about the rates known nationally.
Yeah, if you can speak to the prevalence, because this show is about juvenile justice, the prevalence of trauma in youth who are in or at risk of being involved with the juvenile justice system. Thanks.
And then I will mention also the Hillcrest School, but I want to start with in juvenile detention centers nationwide, when it's self-reported exposure to traumatic experiences, the rates are somewhere between 90 and 100% across child physical and sexual abuse, the witnessing of partner violence, the witnessing of murder, community violence, and accidents. There are gender differences. Girls in the juvenile justice systems have much higher rates of sexual assault and rape histories than boys. In one study, it was 70%. We are working right now also at the Department of Youth Services, the Scioto facility in Ohio, and when I talk to staff there, they report that, from what they can tell, the girls in the system have rates of sexual abuse closer to 100%. We have another study of girls, and this is a study that is three-quarter Caucasian, and then about 20% Hispanic, and it's actually 12% Hispanic and 9% African-American. And these are girls with chronic conduct problems. And these girls, 93% had received physical or sexual abuse, and 63% had experienced both. These are far higher rates than in the general population, several times greater. 80% had witnessed domestic violence, and over half of them had one or both parents in jail. So we have these extraordinarily high rates. When we gave the Childhood Trust Event Survey on the first round of groups that we did at the Hillcrest School, which was an intervention for traumatized youth, those youth who'd been selected for the group, so it wasn't the larger population, reported higher than 10 different kinds of traumatic event per person, and in the second round of groups, we've averaged about 10 per child.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask you, clearly one of the potential consequences of trauma is being at risk for system involvement. What are some of the other consequences of trauma for both children and adolescents?
The first thing to understand is that severe repeated trauma is a biological set of events. It has an impact on brain structure, literally on brain size, for young children, because cortisol, which is released when a child is under stress, has the impact of destroying brain cells. It has an impact on brain function, so that you and neurotransmitter and hormonal regulation. So it's not only psychological, it's also physical, and both the psychological and physical consequences need to be addressed. Lest this discourages people, we know that some of these changes are reversible with intervention. We're just learning this. This whole area of the impact of childhood trauma on human development is 20 years old, and the really good research is in the last 10 years. There are also consequences for physical effect, health. There's a dose effect, particularly if trauma or traumatic stress or adversity persists through several developmental stages, it can be very serious for children. We know then, what are the consequences? What does it look like when we see it? Post-traumatic stress disorder is one consequence. We see that in many youth, so that you have rates up to 8 times higher for youth in JJ facilities, in juvenile justice facilities, than among controls in the community. And then depression is another very, very commonly linked to a trauma history. Anxiety, impulsivity, anger, hypervigilance, sleep disturbances, and then because systems emotionally feel so dysregulated, many youth, for this and other reasons, abuse drugs and alcohol to downregulate. We summarize this in some ways by saying that it looks like emotional dysregulation and behavioral dysregulation. Now, we have studies that document a link between childhood trauma and the behaviors that get adolescents into trouble with parents, with schools, and with the law. That includes high-risk sexual behaviors, conduct problems, and criminal offending. Because the range of responses is so broad, we are working within the National Child Traumatic Stress Network on diagnoses that might encompass this range of responses. And the two names that we have been working with are complex post-traumatic stress disorder or developmental trauma disorder. These are that's a brief summary of some of the impact of childhood traumatic stress.
Thanks. Thank you. That was helpful. Judge Howard, why did you get involved in this issue?
Well, this is a nice segue from what Erna just described, because, of course, at the juvenile court, we have these kids coming in. And especially on the delinquency side, you have to understand that kids don't come to the juvenile court because they are trauma cases. They come to the juvenile court because they have allegedly misbehaved. They've committed some act that would be criminal if they were an adult, or they're acting in a way that makes them unruly. And traditionally, the juvenile court has handed out consequences for those actions. We're sort of like a super parent. They've stepped across the line, and we hand out some consequences for that. And if they don't get the message, then they don't come back, and all is well. And in fact, that's what happens with most of the people that come to the court. Most kids who come to court only come once. But we began to see kids that had a long-term pattern of coming back again and again and again. We turned up the volume as far as the volume would go, and each time our punishment got a little worse. We went up another notch, and yet those kids did not get better. They did not modify their behavior, and we began to think, well, what if we're asking them to do something that they're not capable of doing for some reason? You know, why wouldn't they get the message after all these different times in court? And so It just happened around that time that one of our magistrates went to a training session that one of Ernest's colleagues from the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Putnam, presented, and he presented on this very topic. She came back and said, you know, I'm very afraid that a lot of the kids that we're seeing in court, especially the deep end kids, the kids that keep returning, are kids that are suffering from this this sort of thing, post-traumatic stress. They are traumatized kids, and we're not recognizing this. So we began to look for it, first by just asking questions, and then by actually using a screening tool, and we began to see high rates of trauma among the kids that we saw. So we said, well, we need to learn more so that we can do more to address this, because it was pretty clear that if we didn't do that, we weren't going to have any positive effect on changing the kids.
So what was your role in helping develop a system of care in your jurisdiction that included trauma-informed services and treatment? You explained what you saw wasn't working, the current. So what did you do to help change that?
Well, as we gained the knowledge, then we said we need to bring community partners together, all the different child-serving systems that touch these delinquent schools, and you know, probation officers and child welfare workers and counselors, especially mental health counselors, and talk about this, get a presentation about this. So we had one of the speakers that from the same conference that our magistrate attended, we arranged for her to come and speak in our community. And juvenile judges have a sort of a unique ability to call meetings. People, when a juvenile judge calls a meeting, people sort of feel like they have to come. And that's something that the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges has always encouraged us to do. And that's exactly what happened here. We called the meeting. People did come. They heard the presentation. And many people felt like this was there was sort of an aha moment there. People felt like this very much was something that could be affecting the kids that we were seeing that were getting into trouble. So they wanted to know more and do more, and we started our Stark County Traumatized Child Task Force from that group, and began educating ourselves on what can we do about this, and how do we get our mental health professionals, our clinicians, up to speed on evidence-based treatments that will have effect on this, and build some capacity to treat these kids, and then what sort of tools do we use to identify them, not only in juvenile justice, but we want to go back upstream. We don't want to catch them just as they're going over the falls. We want to catch kids in early childhood facilities that are beginning to have problems, or in grade school. So we wanted to talk to the schools. We wanted to talk to the daycare and the preschools. We wanted to have them alert for this so that the sooner we catch this, the better.
So, Dr. Ellison, perhaps, you know, I had you explain what trauma is, but when we're now looking at interventions, what does trauma-informed treatment involve? So if you can give us some examples, how it's different than other treatments, and what it may look like in the community as well as in the institutions.
Okay, I'm glad to do that.
Great.
Have developed in the past probably 10 to 15 years a well-established trauma treatment, which is called trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, but it's not the only one. So I'm going to start by talking about trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, which I believe was the first therapy that Judge Howard brought into his community. Well, is that correct?
That's correct,
correct,
yeah.
Mike?
Mm-hmm.
That's
yeah.
correct. And made sure then, as you did so, that your agencies had therapists who were trained in it. I'm going to say the challenge, well, we can talk about challenges later, but many people have to go back to special training because it wasn't around when many of us went and got our graduate degrees. It can be a clinic or school-based treatment. It's time-limited, so it should last 12 to 16 weeks. In very complex cases, it can last longer. It is made up of 10 components that include educating both parent and child in the what is trauma, what are its effects, and how can TFCBT trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy help them. A range of coping skills around emotional and behavioral regulation and stress reduction, and an exposure component which involves the child constructing the trauma narrative, telling the story of the trauma. And so it's through the repeated telling of the story that one is able to, in a sense, calm the troubled waters. When one of the problems with PTSD is that when you remember it, the flashbacks can make you feel almost sick. And in some kinds of trauma, such as sexual abuse, there are also disabling feelings of shame that victims experience. So that supported repetition of the trauma story is quite healing. And then we have a cognitive processing component in which, as the therapist listens to both parent and child in individual separate sessions, they are able to identify some cognitions or thoughts people might have about what happened that are perpetuating their feeling bad about it. Many victims blame themselves, for example, or think they did something wrong. And so working with the, and also some victims lose hope and use words about things will never get better, it'll always be the same. So opening up those cognitions, and one of the very good therapists in this field calls that updating your understanding now that you're safe. And then you end with the parent and child sharing the trauma narrative and discussing that. So this is a very powerful treatment that has shown in multi-site studies of 8 randomized trials to be very effective in teaching parent behavior management, reduction of symptoms, including depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and the kind of things that concern the juvenile justice system and the schools, which is children's misbehaviors. It helps with child behavior management. These components are also available in other structures or other protocols that don't yet have as strong an evidence base but are being used, and one of them is one we are now using within the juvenile justice system in the state of Ohio. It was written initially by Robert Pinus, Dr. Pinus, and his colleagues, Drs. Salzman and Lane, and that's trauma and grief component therapy for adolescents. It has many of the same components, but the advantage is it's written specifically for adolescents, and in some cases in the juvenile justice system, caregiver involvement is not practical or possible, and that is taken into account in this later adolescent treatment where, in fact, peer support is developmentally often as important or more important than parent involvement. So in trauma and grief component therapy for adolescents, which we would at this point call a possibly efficacious or promising practice. It has some evidence supporting it in randomized studies, and it's been used with gangs in Los Angeles. But we are also studying it for its applicability within the juvenile justice system. And it, again, is looking looking excellent. We're in our, we have how many pilot groups going now? I think we have 3 completed, 2 underway, and others just getting started. So we'll have more to say about that in another year.
We'll have to have you back on.
Yes. One of the reasons that this was very welcomed at State Department of Youth Services, that they had done another intervention, which was called TARGET, or Trauma Affect Regulation, and that had had excellent results. It had some similar components to what we're doing, and it had resulted in reduction in the necessity for isolation or restraint, which are both possibly traumatic for youth and also can possibly, you know, be injurious to staff. Those are the incidents you want to avoid, and a reduction in threatening behavior by youth. So Julian Ford with Dr. Monique Merrill had done this in Ohio about 5 years ago, and those results are available on slides. I don't think they've been published yet, but they were very promising in showing that within the facility, staff was very enthusiastic about this because it made their lives easier. They don't like putting a child into 4 or 5 point restraints when they get out of control, and finding ways to help them with their emotional behavioral regulation so that they don't lose it was very, very welcome, particularly by line staff.
Great. I want to remind our listeners that if they have any questions for our guests and want to be on air, to call 347-994-1149. You're going to press the number one on your keypad, and Ansa, behind the scenes, will screen you, your call for you. So don't be surprised if someone answers.
Okay.
Sean, maybe you can jump in here and add, do you know of other ways jurisdictions across the country are trying to infuse and inform trauma of care into their juvenile justice system? Dr. Olson mentioned a few. I didn't know if you had some other examples.
Right. Well, I certainly can build on that. I think it's a great segue. So the work that the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges really is based kind of on a triad of approaches. And one is research, and Dr. Olson has covered much of that. And much of this to date is very much rooted in the clinical research world. And there's other social science around trauma within the court systems, but it hasn't been a particular focus of ours. We've really understood that this is emerging in our work in the field, that we see that not all courts are like Mike's, that are very progressive and on top of this and interested in aggressive in informing it through a trauma lens. So we have the training and technical assistance components of the work that we do as well. And I appreciate Erna's comment earlier that expert testimony, as critical as it is not a good way to inform courts about the issues of trauma. So we really speak to the training aspect, the educational piece, of developing awareness in jurisdictions all over the nation about the issues of trauma. We do that, assist that through national conferences, regional, jurisdictional level trainings, technical assistance bulletins, joint articles with the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. And really that's going in and helping people understand what trauma is, the linkages, in this case, to juvenile justice involvement, subsequent linkages to school engagement, then really draw in the research that Erna talked about, so that courts are asking, well, quote-unquote, what works? What should I be looking for in a psychologist or an evaluator? Who's qualified? Are there screening tools? What are they? How do I get to them? So there's the awareness educational component that jurisdictions are being exposed to and increasingly interested in having. What I find interesting personally in my own work is the technical assistance piece, where we do on-site work or office-based work, and I'm kind of I call myself a mutt social scientist, so I approach this work from kind of a clinical, social, psychological, legal perspective. But what I find really interesting on-site and going through courts and allied systems is helping courts understand the idea, the linkages between, well, a couple of things, this idea of hypervigilance in youth and what that looks like and how that can be misinterpreted, and then also looking at their very physical environments and social environments and how that might be linked to traumatic reminders for youth. And so that's literally walking through courts asking questions of, and this is a bit controversial, but, why are you shackling kids? Why do you have your folks working in detention dressed as sheriffs? These kinds of things, they're very aggressive. They put hands on, what kind of restraints are you using? And then trying to develop an awareness of those linkages to potential traumatic reactions from those reminders. So those are some of the things that the National Council and the work that I do in the field are helping jurisdictions slowly integrate a trauma lens into the work.
Great. For many of us, we're very concrete, and we're not from some of this world that, the lingo is new to a lot of our listeners. And you mentioned the hypervigilance in youth. Can you give some examples of what that may look like, just so people have an idea of what you're talking about?
Absolutely. And then I will certainly just dovetail that right over to Erna, because she's the absolute expert on this. But really the way I present it in the trainings that I do is that when kids are constantly scanning the horizon, they're constantly looking around their environment because of their experiences, they're looking for the next threat. They're looking for what's coming around that corner. So they have a very well-developed system, response system, and it's the fight, fly, or freeze, but they have to be constantly on their toes. Well, when you're looking at a kid in your courtroom or in detention or in your work as a social worker or psychologist, that's hypervigilant. They're constantly scanning. They're on their toes. The way that looks can be misinterpreted as a behavioral issue in the sense of perhaps attention deficit disorder or disrespect, or this is somehow linked to a conduct disorder or some of these other more behavioral-based assessments of problematic behaviors, when in reality it's a survival mechanism. So hypervigilance is just that, is being on your toes. And the way I present it is it says it can look to others as being very mad or being very bad, and that's not what it is. It's a very normal, explainable response for kids that have been through trauma. And Erna, you want to add on to that?
Well, could I interrupt and let me give you just an example of that, which I think is really, really hit home with me. And we had a kid that was constantly in trouble at school. He would get in a fight in the cafeteria almost on a daily basis. And of course, the school was punishing this as you know, aggressive behavior. I mean, he was, for no reason at all, he was turning around and hitting kids. What we learned about him as we went into his history is he had been severely physically abused at home. One of those things where he never knew where the next slap or kick or punch was going to come from. And so he could not stand to have somebody behind him in the cafeteria. So if a kid pulled out a chair behind him and it squeaked on the floor, he viewed that as a threat, and he would jump up and attack because that's what he felt he had to do to protect himself. Not cognitively, he didn't think that, but he reacted that way, just as a combat veteran would if they heard a gunshot, or as the caveman might if he heard the saber-toothed tiger growl. So this kid was doing that. Once we figured that was what was happening, we were able to arrange for him to always sit in the cafeteria with his back to the wall, and the events completely ceased.
And it dovetails in the hypervigilance with hyperarousal, which means he's constantly looking and he's constantly ready to go if he has to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. That's really helpful for us out here to have sort of on-the-ground understanding.
This? What we do in treatment, because what happens then with these trauma reminders or trauma triggers is that's the emotional brain, which has been very good at keeping these kids alive in situations where they were often in situations where their lives might have been threatened, particularly with street violence in big cities. And so that emotional brain is very intelligent in that way. When it then tries to transfer into settings that are safe, it doesn't work very well. And one of the things we've been able to do is to, in the trauma and grief component therapy for adolescents, is we have them make a list of the reminders of the traumas that trouble them. And then in the exposure therapy, they can practice dealing with triggers. We need to sort out what is a true danger from what is a trigger in a situation where you're now safe, and how can you use your coping skills not to come out of your seat punching or not to dive under the desk.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So what have been, and this is to all three of you, what have been some of the challenges you've experienced in making trauma-informed programs a part of this, you know, continuum and system of care, and how have you addressed those challenges?
Well, one of the things that we faced, and Erna alluded to this earlier, and that is that much of the research that's been done in this area has been in the last 20 years, and probably the majority of it in the last 10. A lot of it was made possible by CAT scans and MRIs to really look at what was happening in the brain in different circumstances. So it's all pretty new. There are a lot of clinicians and therapists out there that have been practicing for years that were not trained that way. They're not familiar with this, but they've been doing their job for a long time. So as a juvenile court, as we began to learn about this, we might refer a child and say, well, we'd like this child to have trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. And we in many cases, got pushback from the mental health community. They say, "Well, hey, hold on here. You're the judge. You've got a law degree. You know, we're the clinicians. This is our area of expertise. We need to decide what this child needs. Don't tell us what treatment, or don't try to specify." Because, you know, we think we need to work on his conduct, or we think we need to work on some other area. So it's a balancing act there, because on one hand, I admit that I'm not an expert, and I don't want to be dictating to a mental health professional what he or she should use. But at the same time, if I feel that that person is not as up to speed in this particular area as I am, and that it would be best for the child to at least rule out trauma as an underlying factor for behavior, as the judge, I feel like I have a responsibility to insist on some of that. So what I've told therapists is, look, I will defer to you. If you need to convince me, tell me your reasoning. Why do you think this isn't part of it? Have you given them any screenings, or, you know, what have you done to assess this child and determine that I'm incorrect in my belief that this is what that child needs?
Well, this is Sean. From an institutional perspective, I think one of the challenges that we see is just coming over the inertia of common sense and anecdote in working with courts across the nation. And again, they're on a continuum from very progressive to not being so progressive. But for example, the recent kind of re-emphasis on scared tactic programs as being an effective intervention with kids, and we know that the social science research suggests it's not just ineffective, but it's harmful on a number of levels. So
it would be like scared straight, is that sort of thing?
That's scared straight, and A&E's new program, Beyond Scared Straight, 30 years plus of social science research, and not one lick of evidence. So one of the challenges is just overcoming that gut feeling at a jurisdictional level and community level that, well, this feels good. But when you start looking at those programs, particularly through a trauma-informed lens, you start realizing just how misguided they are beyond what the research suggests. So that's one of the challenges that we see at a very inertia-type level within systems.
I would add to that that we have had, in some ways, more success with incarcerated youth when we accompany what we're doing with what we call milieu transformation, where you do the first day not trauma treatment, but a trauma awareness for the entire staff, including the line staff, the cooks, everyone, so that they can understand and interpret behaviors and find ways to de-escalate potentially explosive events that may be linked to the kind of trauma triggers or trauma reminders that Sean was talking about, rather than antisocial behavior. So when we are able to get staff on board and work within institutions where kids are in a structured and safe environment, we've had good success in trauma treatment. One of the challenges, because then I know there's a nationwide movement, and I think there's much to be said for it, to try to reduce rates of youth incarceration and treat them in the community where they would be receiving outpatient treatment, is it's very difficult for families to come in. The whole process of getting families there and to complete the 12 to 14 weeks necessary for these treatments is a challenge. Another big challenge is uncertain and unpredictable funding and turnover. And those are all just the realities you have to factor in as you budget. To overcome these, though, I have to say, I have felt so welcome when people get the news that they can really help kids, because the staff I have worked with at the DYS and at the Hillcrest School really want to be able to help these kids, and they don't want to be, in most cases, they're very positive about finding ways. Some of them very, very dedicated about finding ways to really help these youngsters go straight, find ways to grow up and lead productive lives.
I agree. That's I see that trend across the nation, too.
Well, I think that's kind of a great segue into other tips and considerations you would have for communities that are looking to leverage resources to offer trauma-informed responses. So economically, what does it take? Judge Howard, you talked about who you brought together. Maybe you can even expand on that in the community. Who needs to be involved in this?
Certainly the school, I think I mentioned before, the schools, you would want the mental health community involved. If you have local foundations and things, that's often easy. It's often easier to get a grant from a local foundation, a community foundation of some sort, than it is to get one of the big national grants, because they're extremely competitive. I think it's important to, certainly to have criminal justice. We've done some training with police and first responders, and that's been very helpful. I think almost the way police officers receive mental health training now, so that they know how to approach somebody that might be a mental health case, and approach in a different way than they might a hardened criminal, because certainly they can trigger these kids when they try to arrest them or try to do something with them, modify their behavior in some way. Same thing with schools. If you're threatening with a child that is very highly reactive, it'll just get worse, because as they begin to be threatened, then they stop thinking rationally and everything goes to the midbrain. They don't use the cortex, the part of the brain that's rational. They just go to the survival mode. So having those people trained and understanding this, I think, is helpful. And we did not have a lot of money. We have only had one major grant, and that was fairly recently. So we tried to cobble things together with some small local grants, having people volunteer to do things. Some of this is, certainly some of these treatments are Medicaid reimbursable. So if the treatments are done, that part at least can be paid for.
Okay. Dr. Olson or Sean, do you have other tips, considerations, or resources you would like to share with listeners?
I would like to make sure that everyone is aware of the National Child Traumatic Stress Network website. That's nctsn.org. There is also an excellent website for jurisdictions dealing with youth who have sexual behavior problems, and that's the National Center for the Sexual Behavior of Youth. That's ncsby.org. Those are both excellent resources for more about trauma and more about trauma treatments than I've been able to share in the brief time we have here. I found that collaboration across disciplines is essential, that to go in to help or introduce something new within a system, you need someone like Judge Howard, or you need, in the case with DYS, we had Dr. Monique Merrill, who was our collaborator and is a co-project director on the grant with me, and Dr. Merrill had worked for several years within the DYS system, so she had credibility and knew people. Often when I'm presenting, it makes sense if we're presenting. Judge Howard and I have presented together several times, and I think that collaboration really helps. I've published with judges. And that reaches across, because you have to reach people in the journals they read and the websites they're likely to visit. So I think within agencies, you also need to identify what we call champions. And we often ask if, when we're doing a treatment training, if administrators can attend, this helps them really get it. And if the administrator's the man in charge, whether you're the juvenile judge or the woman in charge, if the person in charge gets it, a lot can happen.
Okay. Sean, anything you wanted to add to that?
The very last thing, very quickly, is just to say that this is not just the right thing to do. But when we start looking at the term of leverage and resources, we have to remember that when jurisdictions and systems are informed around mental health and informed around trauma, which I include in mental health, they become more in tune to diverting kids away from detention. Like Erna mentioned earlier, we realize detention's not good for kids. It's particularly not good for kids that have a trauma history. And what we're starting to see, and we're starting to do work around, is the cost-benefit and the the money it saves from diverting kids out of residential placements. And there's a great example. We just received numbers in from Erie County, New York, which is Buffalo. The last several years been working very hard to integrate mental health into the responses to kids in juvenile justice. It was championed by a mental health person, and they're illustrating just in reductions in residential placements for kids coming into juvenile justice with a mental health lens is about $4.8 billion a year is what the system is saving. That is incredibly powerful information to take to folks and decision makers and check writers to say, this is not only the right thing to do, but ultimately it's going to save us money.
And it's so, Tim, the thing that I try to stress when I talk to other judges and other people in the juvenile system is this is so easy. It's not something, compared to some of the things we try to do with kids, this is cheap and it's extremely easy. There are screening tools that don't take very long to administer that are free on the web, like the UCLA Post-Traumatic Stress Scale or the Children's Events Trust Survey that Cincinnati Children's has on their website. And you can sit down and a probation officer, it doesn't have to be a mental health professional, but a probation officer can sit down with a juvenile, talk through that, answer those questions, and then based on the results, know whether they should send that kid on for a deeper assessment and possible treatment. I mean, why not rule it out? Because if it's a factor, it needs to be addressed or things are not going to get better. So it's almost like a magic wand. I mean, I've never seen anything this good in the 25 years that I've been in juvenile justice.
And I know you, I think each of you may have sent some resources in for our listeners, and those have been posted on the Children's Law Center's website under the Spotlight on Youth tab. And that website is www.childrenslawky.org. We are out of time, so I want to thank all three of you so much for being on today's show and thank the listeners for tuning in. The show will be available on demand at blogtalkradio.com/spotlightonyouth. We'll be on the air again in April with Susan Tobin and Kristen Hildenbrandt from the Ohio Legal Rights Service. They'll be exploring how schools can better respond to youth with behavioral issues to stem the school-to-prison pipeline. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. To stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit Children's Law Center's website. Take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth. Thank you.